From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, the debate over social studies standards for Michigan schools.
It's important if we're going to have standards at a statewide level that they are as neutral as possible, and I think these start out very far left.
So when someone says that they're left-leaning, what they're really saying is, we don't like the examples that are being put into the standards.
What if you had to be 21 to buy tobacco products?
If we pass the Tobacco 21 law in 2019, we predict that by 2025, about 11,000 fewer young people in Michigan would start smoking.
Steve Eiserman back to the Red Wings as the new GM.
This has been a uniformly well-received and well-executed transition. This almost never happens.
Those stories and more for you today on Stateside. Hello and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. This week, the public gets a chance to start weighing in on the latest draft of proposed new social studies standards for Michigan schools. A series of 9 public comment meetings starts this week in Detroit, moves around the state before wrapping up May 9th in Escanaba. Now, standards are the guidelines for the subject areas to be covered in K-12 classrooms. The social studies standards have led to a lot of political arguing over what should or should not be in the standards. Climate change, LGBT rights, Roe v. Wade, the influence on Christianity in U.S. history, biblical figures like Abraham and conservative figures like Ronald Reagan. Here with us now is Tom McMillan, a former Republican state representative, and he's the current treasurer of the State Board of Education. Tom, why are social studies standards so important in your view?
Well, I mean, they're, as far as to get them right is important for me. I think they're so political. There was the statement that we were going to have social studies standards that are not political. That was what the comment was last board meeting. And inherently, they're political. So if we can acknowledge that and say they're going to be political if you're writing standards about politics and about history, what to put in it, what not to put in it. So it's important if we're going to have standards at a statewide level that they are as neutral as possible. And I think these start out very far left. From a conservative standpoint, I think that, you know, the reason why there was pushback initially it's because there's a real general sense among conservatives. Look at the TV. You're seeing young kids embracing socialism and communism, things that, you know, how can you do that if you know the history of Mao and, Lenin and Stalin and the murderous people that, socialism brings up, and what power, the corruption of power at a centralized level. So I think there's a lot of dismay. And so in the grassroots, as far as conservatives go, so if you're going to have these, they want them to be at least educating kids because they think there's a lack of it right now.
What are some of the elements that are most important to you to have included in these new standards?
Well, you know, I am not a social studies standards expert. Judge Warren was one of the few, or one of the only conservatives I know of out of 100 and some people that were working on this latest iteration.
And that's Oakland Circuit Judge Michael Warren, right?
Oakland Circuit Judge Michael Warren, and he clearly says in a 11-page memo to the state board that these are very biased. You know, there's a lot of problems with it, a lot of inconsistencies, confusion. So, I mean, I rely on him because it's the breadth is 135 pages of standards. So, you know, it's important in area like civics to make sure that kids understand the foundation of the country and, what unalienable rights are. It's not very distinguished and clear in the standards that they call them individual rights, which governments largely give and take away. But there are unalienable rights. What are those? There's a lot. I couldn't just encapsulate that in one sentence.
And agreed about it is a long, long draft, and it is available for the public to read online and be able to comment on. Where is there room for compromise?
Well, first of all, I'm not sure. You know, compromise, if these start off far left, compromise would still be quite, maybe less far left, but still, quite left. You know, this is a trick that has been used, so I'm not going to go there. I didn't want them to go out because I thought that they were way too biased to go out in the first place. And if you have quote-unquote compromise, you end up with, a little bit less far left. So I'm not good with that. So, but what I would like to see, I think that in order to make decisions for the kids, make decisions, they have to have clear facts. And I can see that there's a lot of facts that are left out. But I think some of the new things that they put in there with climate change and LGBTQ rights, it's not balanced. You know, they talk about climate change, but are they going to talk about the mistakes that scientists made back in the 70s saying that we were global cooling, and the mistakes they made recently that it was global warming? And now they say they now come up with, climate change, and that how governments will manufacture crises in order to gain power over the citizens and give examples of that. I'd like to see it more balanced on gay rights. I'd like for it to be, talk about how business owners are being forced to violate their consciences and participate in gay weddings or else lose their business. You know, these are things that would provide balance, and I don't see that there would be any of that there.
Tom, what's at stake in all of this, in this process and in developing these standards?
You know, what you teach children about where we've come from says a lot about where we're going to be going. And so, you know, it's important to give them a good sense of history and civics and a decent understanding of economics. And so, you know, you're raising the next generation, and certainly, there have been dictators of the past that said, give me your children and I will, transform your society. And they, took over the education system in order to do that in a negative way. So, certainly, the educating of our children is what's at stake in the public system, at least.
Tom McMillan, thank you so much for speaking with us on Stateside.
All right. Thank you, Cindy.
We turn now to Cassandra Ulbrich. She's a Democrat who's president of the State Board of Education. Cassandra, why is it after 5 years of debates and drafts and countless hours of work, do we still not have updated social studies standards for K-12 in Michigan?
Well, that's an excellent question. Generally, I can tell you it does not take this long to come up with standards. We started this process about 5 years ago, and at the time, we were updating both the social studies standards and the science standards. And I actually thought the science standards would take us much longer. Turns out that the social studies standards are a hot-button issue, very contentious. And so we started the process about 5 years ago, and as it was moving forward, we started to hear some feedback from certain members of the legislature who had some concerns about the standards as they were being proposed. And that kind of put a pause on what we were doing at the time. And Brian Whiston, then the superintendent, said, let's have a work study group to kind of work on some of these concerns, and invited some of the members that had expressed those concerns. We ended up with proposed standards last year that we sent out for public comment, and the comments were, for the most part, very, very negative. So we took those comments, we updated the standards again, and now they are once again out for public comment.
And when we talk about, as you refer to certain members of the legislature, we're talking pretty much, you're talking about Republican and more conservative voices, such as Patrick Colbeck, who ran for governor, and he was a leading critic. So how do you answer critics like them who feel that these latest draft standards are too left-leaning?
I don't think that they're left-leaning at all. So there tends to be a confusion about the difference between standards and curriculum. Standards basically just say what a student should be able to do and know at a certain grade level. So, for example, a standard might be talk about the significance of the end of the Cold War. And part of that becomes the curriculum, where the teachers really come up with, what is the knowledge base and the content around that standard. So we have examples that might be included, but it's not an exhaustive list of examples. So when someone says that they're left-leaning, what they're really saying is, we don't like the examples that are being put into the standards. Not necessarily that the standards themselves are inappropriate. So that's really the conversations we're having right now.
What is most important, Cassandra, to you to have in these standards?
For me, the most important thing is that we are teaching our young people how to be critical thinkers. So not just to memorize dates and memorize who the people are in significant events in history, but to also be able to take that a step further and say, this is why this is important. You know, how do I understand the significance of things that happened in history and what they might mean for me today? That's why we have standards. It's about being able to establish how you understand historical facts and figures, but also incorporate them into what you see around you every day today to understand what your own thoughts are and your own opinions, and to be able to develop those as you're moving forward through your academic career.
Is there anything that you would find to be unacceptable to be included in these social studies standards?
Well, I was diametrically opposed to the standards last year, and the reason for that is because it included some things within the standards themselves that I thought were not appropriate. So, for
Such
example,
as, yeah.
So, for example, they treated civil rights like it was a zero-sum game. So one of the standards actually said that, you know, when a marginalized group gains civil rights, that someone else's civil rights have been infringed upon. That's not how civil rights work. There was no way I could ever support including something like that in the standards.
Where could you compromise with conservatives?
I think there's lots of compromise. One of the things that we've heard is that they want to have, for example, Ronald Reagan and Gorbachev mentioned as part of the end of the Cold War. I don't see any problem with adding those as examples. So I think there are things that we can do to alleviate some of those concerns. But at the end of the day, we're not going to turn our standards over to something like what we saw last year, where, again, we're teaching, you know, civil rights as a zero-sum game.
What will you be looking for and listening for in these upcoming public hearings and the online public comments?
So much like we did last year, we want to know, first of all, what the reactions are from folks from all over the ideological spectrum and to get some feedback and some take on that. We also have invited educators to come and talk about, you know, what they're teaching in their classroom and how the standards might be impacting those as well. You know, we open a wide net so that anyone who has any thoughts or opinions is welcome to share them and, you know, give us feedback. The feedback is what makes the standards better.
Cassandra Ulbrich is president of the State Board of Education. Later in the evening, you can go to the stateside page at michiganradio.org. We will post links where you can check out the dates and locations of the public comment meetings and also a link for you to file your comment online. Cassandra, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Still to come, we'll talk Red Wings and Steve Yzerman with Michigan Radio's John U. Bacon. Then, a new effort underway to offer doula care for young women who have survived sexual assault.
There's a lot of ways that teens are triggered, and one of those ways is pregnancy and having lots of changes to their bodies.
All of that after the break. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You are listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. It was the news fans had been hoping to hear. Steve Yzerman coming home to the Detroit Red Wings to be the new general manager and executive vice president. Michigan Radio Sports commentator John U. Bacon is here. And John, I don't know about you, but I did not pick up one whiff of grumbling or criticism about this move. Just what is it about Steve Yzerman? People seem to universally like him, whether they are Wings fans or not.
Think about how long have we been talking about sports? It never, ever, ever works out this way. Harbaugh coming back to Michigan, good as a savior, by half the state.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Not by the Spartan fans and so on. This has been a uniformly well-received and well-executed transition. This almost never happens.
Why do you call this well-executed?
For a few reasons. First of all, as far as the magnitude of what just happened, I was thinking about this as you and I talked over the weekend. In the last 40 years, there are probably 4 days you can circle as the most important in Wings history. Ilitch is buying the franchise, drafting Yzerman.
Yzerman. I remember hearing Steve Yzerman. Yeah.
Back in 82, yeah. Clearly essential. Hiring Scotty Bowman and then hiring Yzerman again. And those are the four pillars, in my opinion. Why was it so well received? Why was it so executed? Ken Holland is the answer.
Why?
Well, he's been the longtime GM and done, in my opinion, a phenomenal job, all the playoff runs and so on. But he put his own ego aside, hired Yzerman, and still going to be in the front office to help him out. But it takes a guy like that to make the transition work.
Which, my understanding is, that's what Jimmy Devolano did for Ken Holland. Stepped aside and let him move
in. A good
in.
Model. Ken Holland is a bigger man than most, frankly. He's 5'8". He's my size. But For a confident guy, he's had very little ego about this stuff.
Well, during the press conference when he was introduced Friday as a general manager, Eiserman asked fans to be patient. Are they going to be patient? Does that Eiserman aura buy him a lot of good grace?
It buys him some. As you've noticed, patience is the least common of all the traits of any sports fan. He needs 3 or 4 years at least. They're going to give him 2 before they start carping about this or that. But it's basically a full rebuild, and it's worse than a full rebuild. When you're at the bottom of the league, you get the top draft pick, right? They're not at the bottom. They can't even lose right. They're losing the bottom third. Not good enough. So he needs to do a lot of wheeling and dealing to get this team where it needs to be. And also, as you and I have talked about the last couple of years, they have no style of play right now. They're not a defensive team. They're not an offensive team. They're not a hitting team. They're not a skating team. They have no identity. So that takes 2 or 3 years also to stamp that.
Yet, Eiserman said on Friday he supported the recent 2-year contract extension for coach Jeff Blashill.
He has no choice.
Okay, so he's got that. So thinking of what he did in his years in Tampa Bay, which, you know, they made the playoffs, but they never won a Stanley Cup during his time there. But what might we expect from him? What do we know about him that's going to tell us what kind of leader and manager he'll be?
Well, to give him more credit also, they got the Lightning to the Stanley Cup Finals. This last year, they won the President's Cup, which is the best team in the NHL during the regular season. They tied his own record with 62 wins during the season. Now, you got shootouts and so on now, a little cheesy. But he had it put together a phenomenal organization, not just a good one. What can they expect? They can expect a lot of trades. You have to have a better farm system feeder to make this work. You can't get them all through trades. It's too expensive with the salary cap. You have to get some cheap young players.
And grow them.
And grow them.
Which is, I guess, why he and Holland are off to Sweden.
That's right. Well, what was the key to the Red Wings? I mean, getting
the
guys
Russian
like
five.
Russian five, Lidstrom, a 9th-round pick. You have to get some sleepers out there that no one else sees.
Yeah, and it made me wonder when you think about what was done by Devilano getting started with that whole Russian five. Can you catch lightning in a bottle like that again?
It's harder because the Wings have already done it. So everyone knows, oh, that's how you do it. So they're doing it too. So it's not as simple as it was in some ways 20 years ago. But Eiserman's a smart guy. He's also, by the way, for being a sweet person, a kind, calm soul, he is insanely, intensely competitive. You can smash his face and he comes back for the next game. So don't think for a second that losing is okay with this guy.
So what do you think? How long will it be before Detroit Red Wings fans will be seeing the team playing at this time of the year?
2 years.
All right.
2 years, maybe 3. But by year 4 and 5, they'll have a machine.
And he did point out some good building blocks, Dylan Larkin, AA, some of the other players that
exactly.
He feels he's got something to work with, but you need to...
Need to put it all together. And look, the goal here is not to make the playoffs. They've done that many times. He wants to build the kind of team that he was playing on, the kind that will go deep into the playoffs and win the thing. Not the same thing.
Michigan Radio Sports Commentator, John Eubank. And John, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Some troubling research from Penn State finds children who suffer childhood sexual abuse are more likely to grow into teenagers who engage in risky sexual behaviors, which leads to teen pregnancy and motherhood. Well, there is an effort underway to offer trauma-sensitive doula and midwifery care for young women who live at Angel House. It's a residential program for pregnant and parenting teen girls in Lansing. Tashmika Torek is founder of the Firecracker Foundation, and Connie Perkins is here. She's founder and lead midwife of the home birth and doula practice, Red Cedar Birth and Botanicals. Tashmika, what is the mission of the Firecracker Foundation?
So the mission of the organization is to honor the bravery of children who experience sexual violence by building a community invested in the healing of their whole being.
So how did that lead to this idea of matching doulas with teen moms to be at Angel House?
So we found out through the work that we're doing that sexual violence shows up in so many different ways. There's a lot of ways that teens are triggered, and one of those ways is pregnancy and having lots of changes to their bodies. And if we're going to honor children and all survivors, then we need to show up for all the ways that trauma impacts their lives. And so that's kind of how we came to this idea. We started with a yoga program, a trauma-sensitive yoga program, and Connie, who was the assistant, started getting all of these questions from the teens about their bodies and their babies and their, you know, their upcoming births and the aftercare. And we just started to think, like, what would it look like if we could answer those questions in an intentional way?
Okay. And just give us a little bit about Angel House, why it's a good partner for this trauma-sensitive program.
So Angel House is a residential facility for pregnant or parenting teens. And so they live there with either, they're either pregnant or parenting. So some of them have their children there. And we had already been in a partnership with Child and Family Charities, which is the organization that that houses Angel House, to provide the trauma-informed yoga. And so it was just a natural fit. We have built such a really positive and healthy relationship with that organization as partners. And so this was just a natural switch into a new venture together.
Connie Perkins, just to get us all on the same page, walk us through the difference between what a midwife does and what a doula does.
Yeah, I actually get that question a lot. So the difference is one's a healthcare provider and one is a support system. So it's kind of like the difference between bringing your friend with you to your birth and having your provider there. So when I'm working as a midwife, I'm doing all of the medical aspects of their care. So we're doing all of their physical checks, checking vitals. I'm basically there to keep them alive and safe during their pregnancy. When I'm working as a doula, I'm there more for their emotional aspect of what's going on. So we're kind of decoding what they're being told during their doctor's appointments. We're talking about questions they have. We're helping them get information and education about the choices that they're going to have to make. And then we're also providing comfort support and a physical presence during their labor.
So how can midwives and doulas, you know, help women and girls who survive sexual assault kind of get them through pregnancy, birth, and on to parenting?
I mean, I think one of the biggest things we can do is just acknowledge the ways that sexual assault affect pregnancy and parenting. Sometimes it's a surprise, even when we're working with adult survivors, they don't expect that this really exciting, joyful thing is also going to be really triggering. And when that happens, there's a lot of shame and guilt because you're supposed to be happy. You're supposed to be excited about this baby. And if instead you feel scared or worried or triggered by this baby, then there's just a lot of internalized shame around that. And so I think that honestly, the biggest thing that we can do for them is acknowledge it and warn them ahead of time. Like, hey, here are some things you might feel. You might not feel this way. You might be totally great and have a trigger-free pregnancy and delivery, but it's possible that these things could happen, and that's okay. And just having that acknowledgement of the situation can sometimes really diffuse and help them reach out for help when they need it.
Tishmeka, how have you seen, in your work through the Firecracker Foundation, how does sexual abuse affect the likelihood of teen pregnancy?
That's a great question. One of the consequences of sexual, like untreated child sexual trauma, is earlier pregnancy, actually. And I'm glad that you asked that question because it's not something that is commonly talked about. And there's also a lot of that that when Connie was talking about how to support them, it's also about recognizing that just because a teen has been either with consent or without consent, been sexually active, that they have any understanding of what is happening with their body. And so although children are introduced to ideas of sex early when they are abused, they don't often get the sex education that they need to prevent pregnancy or to even be engaged in a consensual relationship that is healthy.
And you're building that trust, and I know you've been working with some of these girls at Angel House. What kinds of things, as they begin to trust you and open up, what kinds of things do these girls want to talk about?
They want to talk about everything. I mean, they just want someone who is excited to talk with them and excited about their babies. You know, they want to show me their kids. They want to introduce me to them. They want to talk about every little tiny bump, bruise, and pimple that's going on their bodies. You know, part of the reason that we started this is because, like, they're walking into yoga and being like, hey, take a look at this thing on my boob. And I'm just like, whoa, this is not the space for that. Let's figure this out a different way. So they really are just open books, and they're just really desperate for someone who wants to listen.
Tishmeka, how many young women do you want to serve?
Well, this year we anticipate that we'll work with up to about 50 girls. We do hope that within the next couple of years, we'll be able to open this up as a resource for the community. I think one thing that's really important about the way that we're providing a trauma-informed midwifery service is that people who experience sexual violence often don't get an experience in their life that validates their consent and also reinforces their consent and supports it. And so I view this as something that would be useful for all youth who experience, you know, early pregnancy or who have an experience of sexual violence and you know, want to have a family. I feel like this is something that we could replicate in the community.
In fact, that leads to, you know, as other parts of the state hear our conversation, what can other cities learn from what you're doing and how are you funding this work?
We're funding this work through private donors, grant funding. Like every nonprofit, we're asking for donations at all times in many places. But we're really hoping that we can build something that is sustainable. And so we're always looking at ways to, you know, teach these practices to other communities. So to other organizations that want to invite us in to talk about these things, that's an income builder for us. The other way that people can help is to just spread the word and talk to other people who might be willing to donate or share resources with us. We partner with other organizations to write grants all the time so that we can offer this service to other places.
I wanted to point out one of the things, you know, you're asking what other communities can learn from this and do, you know, similarly. One of the things that I feel like is really different about the program that we're building is that we're not bringing in volunteer doulas or free doulas to come to these births. I feel like something that I feel really passionately about is that when we have an at-risk or high-risk population, we need to give them the most educated, most experienced people that we can. And I often see volunteer doulas or, you know, people, everyone, their heartstrings are pulled when you talk about this population. Mm-hmm. Everyone wants to help. Everyone wants to do something. And so we get people saying like, well, I'll just volunteer. Like they just need free doulas. And that's not sustainable. It doesn't create a program that's going to last because no one can do this work for free forever. And I really, it was really important to me when we started talking about this, that we have doulas who are exceptionally well-trained, who have supervision, who go through anti-oppression and anti-racist trainings and just make sure that they're really, really prepared to walk into the situation and be a voice in the room.
Yeah, and I would add that the other thing that other spaces might be able to learn from us is this program didn't come because Connie said to me one day, I mean, it sort of did, but she said to me one day that this would be a great idea, but I didn't say, okay, let's do it. I said, let's talk to our survivors. Let's work with the youth that we're already in relationship with and see if this is something that would be meaningful to them, because every program, every move that we make at the Firecracker Foundation really is based in the idea that it should be survivor-led and survivor-focused. And so we did, and we waited, and the need was so obvious that we thought we have to do this, and then we also have to have it match our values, which, as Connie said, we want to be able to pay people to do this work. We want it to be sustainable. We want it to be high quality and consistent so that our clients will be able to count on the relationship that they build with the midwife and with the doulas and make sure that they have something that is always going to be there for the long term.
Even now that we're getting underway and getting started, we're still looking at the teens to give their input on what they want. A big thing, so I just, every week I go there and just kind of float around and talk with them about what's going on. And right now, all I'm doing is asking them what they want and pointing out that I don't want to be just another grown-up in their life who felt bad for them, decided they needed something and came and did it to them. And so instead I'm going in there and I'm saying, you know, you're here holding your baby. What would have been helpful when you were pregnant? What did you want? What were you looking for that you didn't find? And trying to make sure that they are having the biggest voice in how we structure this program and what services we provide for them.
You can find out lots more about the work that the Firecracker Foundation is doing, this trauma-sensitive doula and midwifery care program, as well as all the other work they are doing to provide healing services for child survivors of sexual trauma. You can go to their website, firecrackerfoundation.com. firecrackerfoundation.org. We have been talking to the founder of the Firecracker Foundation, Tashmika Torok, and also Connie Perkins, midwife and doula, who is involved in providing this trauma-informed care. And we want to thank you both for sharing your passion and your work with us on Stateside.
Thank you so much for having us. Thank you for really helping us get the word out about this program. It's so important, and we feel very strongly about not only what we're doing now, but what the potential is for the future.
Yes, thank you so much for having us here. It's really great to talk about this program. We're so excited about it.
And our always friendly reminder that we love hearing from you and finding out just what issues and stories that you're focusing on or people that you want to hear more about. It's so easy to let us know. You can find us on Facebook. Search for Michigan Radio. We're on Twitter at Stateside Radio and MichiganRadio.org. Just click the link that says Stateside. After the break, from miscarriage to motherhood, Polly Rosenwake examines the baby years in her debut collection of short stories. Then, a push in Michigan to raise the legal age to buy tobacco from 18 to 21. We'll talk with a researcher who thinks that's a good idea.
If we pass the Tobacco 21 law in 2019, we predict that by 2025, about 11,000 fewer young people in Michigan would start smoking.
That is in 10 minutes. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. We're just a few short weeks away from Mother's Day. Store shelves are stocked with cards and gifts for mom. But there is so much more to motherhood than the sentiments in a greeting card, and it is not all sweetness and roses. For every moment of sublime happiness, there are moments of frustration, disappointment, and wondering if your kids drew the short straw when they got you as a mom. Polly Rosenwake explores the many facets of womanhood and motherhood in her debut short story collection, Look How Happy I'm Making You. Polly has published reviews and essays and stories in many outlets, including the New York Times Book Review. She's the fiction editor for Michigan Quarterly Review. Polly Rosenwake lives in Ann Arbor with poet Cody Walker and their two daughters. Welcome. Good to have you here.
It's so great to be here.
I really did enjoy this collection of stories. And I know you're the mom of two, and I'm wondering if the inspiration for this collection of many looks at being a woman and being a mother, did it come before or after you had your daughters?
Well, it mainly came after. Cody and I had our first daughter in 2010. And so I'd written a few of the stories that ended up being in the book beforehand, but I didn't come up with a theme of I will write about this period of pregnancy and new motherhood until my daughter was about a year old and I was just trying to process the experiences that I had and I wanted to put them into fiction.
Tell me a little more about that theme that you chose to unite these stories.
I started with a story about a couple that are attempting to conceive a child and having trouble doing so. And then I had a story about a woman who chooses to have an abortion, and then a story about a woman who has a miscarriage, which I had two on the way to having my two daughters. And so I wanted to kind of express this idea that reproductive processes and choices are not always as easy as we feel that they might be when we say, okay, we're ready to have a baby.
Let's do it. You know, I'm thinking of some of the stories that really, I thought, really rang true. You have the story, Love Bug, Sweetie Dear, Pumpkin Pie, etc. And the couple in this story, Henry and Serena, they're all going to be that couple who didn't have kids, who lived in that house free of soggy Cheerios on the floor. And I think so many people have said that, oh, let's not have kids. I remember my friend Carol saying, we'll be the ones, we can visit each other's houses, and they'll be neat. She had four, I had two. That rang true. You have the story of a woman struggling with infertility, as you mentioned, and you also have a powerful story, period, ellipsis, full stop, about a writer named Cora experiencing a miscarriage. I went through that many, many years ago, and the feelings and thoughts she had rang true. And now you say you had that happen a couple times as well.
Yeah, and that story is probably, I mean, the stories are fiction, but there are some that are closer to my own experience than others. And that one is about a woman who's just moved with her partner to a new town, which was what I had done. when I had the miscarriage, and is also trying to figure out her career. She's an editor, but she's having trouble finding clients, and so she's just kind of flailing in general. And then when she has the miscarriage, she feels like she's doing everything wrong, and her body is failing her, and she's not, the trajectory is not happening in the way that she thought it would.
Well, you know, you stop and you think about, we talk a lot about our kids. We don't talk so openly about infertility struggles and certainly about miscarriage. Maybe we quietly tell our stories to each other.
Yeah.
When I had my miscarriage, I was surprised how many people came over and said, yeah, I went through that too.
Yeah,
where you don't know it, you do feel like you failed. What are we missing, do you think, when we don't feel free to talk more openly about these challenges?
I think it contributes to women continuing to have that feeling like I've done something wrong, or it's so rare, when miscarriage actually isn't that rare, sadly. It's about 10 to 20% of pregnancies end in miscarriage. But that is the kind of thing I think you don't know until you're in those childbearing years and you realize this is actually quite a common experience. And I think if more people talk about it, it becomes more normalized and less fraught for how we think about it.
I know. And there is that feeling of, do I want to take this plunge or not? Would you mind reading for us?
Of course.
Love this. This is about Serena when her husband Henry decides he has the baby itch, and he announces over breakfast, honey, I want to have a baby with you, that we could be the kind of parents we wished we had. So could you read from us as Serena ponders this turn of events?
Sure. People change. We could be the kind of parents we wished we had. Serena concentrated on whisking the bright eggs into milk. Seeing her friends become mothers had only solidified her lack of interest in becoming one herself. She was content to be the pseudo-aunt, to buy the children beautiful picture books and fancy cupcakes, spend a few hours in their self-absorbed company, and then drive home in her clean car. She didn't envy the interminable job her friends had taken on, the way they could never have an uninterrupted conversation when their kids were around, the way they complained about being so tired, the way they looked so tired, even the occasional pleasure they seemed to take in their children. And sure, the kids were cute in ponytails or frog boots, and they said funny things sometimes. Well, frankly, it embarrassed her. The exaggerated smooches on grubby cheeks, the crowing about some developmental achievement that, soon enough, would mean nothing at all. So the kid could eat solid food, walk, talk, recite the alphabet, pump his legs on a swing, memorize a Disney song. Who couldn't, sooner or later? But now, Henry was under the spell of that biological enchantment to recombine DNA for the 100th, billionth, whatever time. And what would be the marital compromise? Have half a kid?
Polly Rosenwick, reading from the story Love Bugs, Sweetie Dear, Pumpkin Pie, etc. One of the many really terrific stories in her debut short story collection, Look How Happy I'm Making You. What kind of reaction are you getting from readers as they go through this exploration of the often painful, messy sides of being a woman?
Yeah, well, for the most part, I'm getting really great feedback and people just being happy that these stories are being expressed and telling me that they relate. I did, though, actually get a one-star review the other day where somebody said, not for expectant mothers, and that it gave her nightmares thinking about these things that might happen. And so I'm not surprised that I came up against that a little bit, too. But I think for the most part, people are saying, we just want to talk about these things more and we want them to be more out in the open.
What do you hope people take out of reading your book, Look How Happy I'm Making You? And by the way, great title.
Thank
you. Say to them when, in those worst moments, I'm making you happy. Look right. How happy I'm making you. What do you hope they take away from it?
I hope people feel an intimacy with the stories. I think fiction can really provide that kind of in-depth dive into someone else's experience, and that understanding that feeling a range of emotions around having a new baby is okay. Yes, you're happy and it's amazing, but you can also sometimes feel challenged and frustrated, and you can feel that and express that and get through it.
And family life can be messy. Polly Rosenzweig, yes. Her debut short story collection is Look How Happy I'm Making You, Exploring Womanhood and Motherhood, and it is a good read. Polly, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you. It's been such a pleasure.
How do we keep teens from beginning to smoke? One idea, a Tobacco 21 law that limits tobacco sales to people 21 or older instead of the current age of 18. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell said he's going to introduce federal legislation to raise the legal age to buy tobacco from 18 to 21. He calls it a top priority when the Senate returns from recess in just a few days. A University of Michigan study finds that doing this, raising the tobacco purchase age, could prevent thousands of premature deaths in Michigan. One of the researchers studying what happens when a Tobacco 21 law is passed is Holly Jarman, and she's with us now, an assistant professor at the University of Michigan School of Public Health with us via Skype. Holly, welcome.
Oh, hi. It's a pleasure to be here.
So let us cut right to the chase. If someone has to be 21 to buy tobacco cigarettes in Michigan, how many people could that keep from starting to smoke?
Well, we did some modeling because we were very interested in this question. And so if we passed a Tobacco 21 law in 2019, we predict that by 2025, about 11,000 fewer young people in Michigan would start smoking, which is quite a significant number.
And how many premature deaths could be averted by that?
So by 2100, so when we do this modeling, we have to do it over a longer time period, we would avert something like 17,000 smoking-related deaths. And about 198,000 fewer people would have started smoking by that point.
Now, tell me, how did you construct this research? Help us understand how you came to this to these conclusions.
We had a couple of my colleagues who had worked on a report for the Institute of Medicine, which looked at this nationally. And we said, well, there are so many states and localities looking at Tobacco 21. Can we take the models that you made for the national data and apply them to Michigan? Can we find Michigan data and come up with some specific numbers so that if decision makers in our state decide to go forward with a Tobacco 21 law, they'll have some evidence to go on?
So what are the main components of your study, Holly?
So we did three things. First of all, we did some modeling. We looked at quantitative data to see what the effect would be on health in Michigan of a Tobacco 21 law. Second, we went and did some case studies. So we talked to people in comparable communities in the state of Ohio to see how they had implemented their Tobacco 21 law. And the third thing we did was actually a national survey of young people aged 14 to 24, because we think it's very important that people who are actually going to be affected by this law, young people, are actually engaged in the decision making. And so there we saw a majority, about 60% of the respondents to our survey, supported the adoption of a Tobacco 21 law. About 29% were against the introduction of a Tobacco 21 law. We saw a similar majority in Michigan, about 60% support. And I think it's really important to just shed a light on the debate that's happening amongst young people about e-cigarettes, about Juul, about the health effects, and also things like individual responsibility and their individual rights.
And we've seen, as you put in your report, seven states and some 400 municipalities have already passed Tobacco 21 laws. And a measure was introduced in Michigan's House of Representatives in January. Am I correct on that?
Yes, that's right.
And how much support are we seeing in Lansing for doing this?
We still don't know. I think there's definitely some support amongst representatives. This was a bipartisan supported piece of legislation that was introduced in January. We've also seen some interest in the governor's office. During the governor's elections last year, Governor Whitmer, part of her platform was Tobacco 21. And so that was part of the motivation for this. If we have bills being introduced in the legislature and some interest at the executive level in our state, we really need to be armed and prepared with some data to make a sensible decision.
And that's what this report attempts to offer up.
That's one of the things we're trying to do. In addition to the modeling, we also then went and did some case studies in Ohio, talking to people in those Ohio cities who have implemented Tobacco 21. And we tried to understand how they were doing that and what they were doing that was successful and what they were doing that had been less successful.
And it seems Columbus came across looking pretty good as far as having an especially well-crafted policy.
Yes, that implementation is so important. Unless we really go into a Tobacco 21 law thinking carefully about how we're going to put that law into practice, there's a chance that the law will be much less effective. We took a look at Columbus and Cleveland and then two smaller cities and looked at how they'd gone about implementing their Tobacco 21 laws. And Columbus seemed particularly successful to date because they had actually introduced a system of tobacco licensing. And the people that we talked to said this was giving them much greater ability to form relationships with local retailers, to collect data about where young people in Columbus were getting their tobacco products from, and to follow up in those cases where retailers really were selling to underage people, to follow up by suspending the license or charging a fine, which is a bit of a better leverage than the way they had been previously organizing access to tobacco in Columbus.
And Columbus put some money in there too, didn't they? Funding to help implement these the policy and also educate retailers.
Yes, they did. And I think that's vital. We have some places in Michigan that actually do this. If you look at Ingham County, for example, Ingham County has had a tobacco retail license for some years. And they also have put a little bit of money into assembling a database, so understanding who their tobacco retailers are in their community, and then spending a bit of money to actually provide education and training for local clerks and local retailers. And Columbus was doing a very similar thing. And we noticed that in both of these cases, we actually see in the data a reduction in the number of young people able to buy tobacco products in the retail environment.
Holly, have we seen pushback in any communities that are working to get a Tobacco 21 law?
Yes. So in Michigan, currently, we have two places that have passed a Tobacco 21 law. One is Ann Arbor and the other one is Genesee County. And in Genesee County, there was actually some legal action against that law. And so a local company that is an oil company and a local business brought this to a legal case and challenged the ability of Genesee County to pass such a law. And the judge actually has suspended the law in Genesee County. This decision is going forward to further legal appeal. But you can see that there's still some opposition to Tobacco 21. And there are some parts of our state law that make it difficult for localities to actually pass their own laws and decide how tobacco retail will work within their own jurisdictions.
Holly, how does this research on Tobacco 21 and making it harder for under 21s to purchase tobacco, how does that fit with what we're learning about teens and vaping? Are we just pushing kids from one tobacco delivery system to another?
A lot of the Tobacco 21 laws that are being passed now really do cover all tobacco products for those under age 21. So we're not just talking here about cigarettes or little cigars, which are quite commonly used by young people in Michigan. But we are also talking about things like electronic cigarettes, Juul, and other more novel products would be included in these kinds of laws, including things like paraphernalia. So we have to be careful. At the moment, we're still, as researchers, learning more about how e-cigarettes or vaping might be likely to harm the health of young people. But we do know that the CDC recommends that those under the age of 21 should not use these products and that they're not safe. We need to balance that in our community against the likelihood that someone who is older and already a smoker may well get a benefit from using an e-cigarette product if they find it very hard to quit. There is still more research to be done on this, but these Tobacco 21 laws are designed to cover comprehensively all tobacco control products, not just cigarettes.
Holly Jarman is an assistant professor at the University of Michigan School of Public Health, and their new study finds that raising tobacco purchase age to 21, and that is all forms of tobacco, would prevent thousands of premature deaths in Michigan. Thank you so much for sharing your research with us, Holly.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Today's Stateside was directed by Mercedes Mejia and engineered by Bob Scott. Our executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors today are Mike Blank, April Van Buren, Sarah Leeson, Bella Isaacs, and Razi Jaffrey. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.